Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm George Hammond, Chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized tonight's event. It's my great pleasure to welcome our audience here in San Francisco and our online and radio audiences, and to welcome Candida Ross, Professor of New Testament and Early Christianity at the University of Notre Dame, to be speaking about The Myth of Persecution, her new book.
Thank you for the introduction, and thank you to you all for coming and listening to what I have to say about persecution. When I was growing up, I heard a story told by Christians of all denominations about the history of the church. The story went that for the first 300 years of its existence, Christians were persecuted for their faith. Beginning with Jesus, Stephen, and the apostles, Christians were hunted down, tortured, and executed. Followers were forced to meet secretly in catacombs to avoid detection. And when they were discovered, they were racked, beaten, and scourged. Tens of thousands, including women and children, were condemned to the arena to face wild animals, strangled quietly in jail, or publicly burned alive. They're the action heroes of the early church, complete with good looks, showdowns with Satan, and pithy one-liners. And they have inspired generations of Christians ever since. Christian children of all denominations alternate games of cops and robbers with Christians and Romans. And when Roman Catholic teenagers pick their confirmation names, martyrs overwhelmingly win the saintly popularity contests. Pop references aside, martyrs and persecution have left a deep impression in the Christian psyche. The history of early Christianity establishes it as a religion of innocent sufferers, as a church under attack. And in periods of crisis or perceived crisis, Christians of all stripes have returned to the early church in order to find themselves and understand their experiences. This is true even today. In 2011, Republican presidential candidate Rick Santorum publicly complained that the gay community had gone out on a jihad against him. In the course of the last election, similar statements were made by Mitt Romney, Rush Limbaugh, and Bill O'Reilly, to name but a few. During the debate over the HHS mandate last year, Catholic bishop and University of Notre Dame trustee Bishop Daniel Jenke said that President Obama was attacking Christians just like the Roman emperors, Hitler, and Stalin. This is not just a case of election day banter. Just recently, Fox News accused NBC of persecuting Christians because of a skit that had aired on Saturday Night Live. All of these instances of people describing themselves as persecuted are tugging on the same idea, an idea deeply lodged at the heart of Christianity, the idea that Christians are innocent victims persecuted by their very nature for following Christ. This belief has a basis in Scripture. In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus instructs his followers to take up their crosses and follow him, and he predicts that his followers will be asked to defend him in courtrooms. Then again, in the very same passage, he predicts that some of those standing before him will not taste death before the arrival of his kingdom in glory. We may have a new pope, but we do not yet have the second coming. This raises the question, why do we accept the prophecy of persecution when the statement about the disciples living until the last judgment was clearly untrue? The reason why the statement about persecution has had such a pronounced impact on our understanding of Christian history is that it is believed to have been proven in the experiences of the early church. if the prophecy had not come true in the early church, then, like the statement about the apostles being alive at the last judgment, we might have decided to interpret it metaphorically. As it is, we have taken it as a statement about what it means to be a Christian, and a prophecy about the course of human history. The fact is that the traditional history of Christian martyrdom is wildly overblown. In the first 3 centuries of the Common Era, there were no more than 10 years of the kind of persecution described in Sunday school. Outside of these short periods, some Christians did die, but for reasons that are what we might call political, they died as criminals. When we look at the evidence, it becomes clear that the stereotype of cruel Roman emperors constantly persecuting the innocent Christians is a myth. In my book, I discuss a number of different topics: the pre-Christian origins of Christian martyrdom, the evidence or lack of evidence for the persecution of Christians, the reasons why the Romans disliked Christians, the way that Christian authors forged martyrdom stories, and misconceptions we have about the character of martyrs themselves. But I'm going to focus the majority of my lecture today on the evidence for Roman persecution. What do we know about Romans persecuting Christians? And why is it that Romans ever persecuted Christians? After all, if I can't convince you that the Sunday school narrative is a myth, you probably won't be all that interested in hearing about who created that so-called myth. Before I begin, however, I want to talk about definitions. There is a difference between persecution and prosecution. Just because a Christian dies violently doesn't mean that person was persecuted. A persecutor targets representatives of a specific group for undeserved punishment merely because they are a member of that group. A person is prosecuted because they have broken a law. This distinction is complicated with respect to the ancient world because religion and politics were so closely intertwined with one another, and because religious freedom was not an inalienable human right. You simply couldn't have said, "I'm free to practice my religious beliefs." But there is something different about being prosecuted under a law, however unjust that law is, that is not designed to target you or rout out your group. It might be unfortunate. It might be unfair. It might be deeply unjust, but it is not persecution. And it is very far from the modern caricature of how Romans treated Christians. With that in mind, let's turn to the evidence. The first to die after Jesus are Stephen and the apostles. Stephen was a young Greek Jew who was a follower of the Jesus movement and who died when he was stoned by Jews in the Acts of the Apostles. From a legal and historical perspective, the death of Stephen sounds a lot like lynching or mob violence. But there are indications in the story that what Luke, the author of this story, wants us to think is that the death of Jesus is just like that of Stephen. In fact, there are a number of parallels between the deaths of Stephen and Jesus. It's highly unlikely that the close similarities between these two stories are coincidental. The historical Stephen would have no way to know what Jesus actually said at his execution or at his trial, because he wasn't there, and because he died before the Gospels were written. If there's any doubt about the lack of historicity here, it's dispelled by the fact that the evangelist Luke constantly does this. He's constantly setting up parallels between events in the life of Jesus and events in the life of the church. Take, for example, the baptism of Jesus and the Pentecost event. At both events, the Spirit descends on Jesus and then on the church, giving life to their missionary activity. What's happening here is that Luke is making a theological point. This is a literary device that expresses Luke's conviction about the relationship of Jesus to the church. The church will be persecuted just like Jesus was persecuted. The problem is that we can't be certain that the details of the story are accurate. When we turn to the deaths of the apostles, things don't grow any simpler. The problem here is that our sources for these events are the stuff of legend, not history. The documents that contain the stories about the deaths of the apostles are known as apocryphal Acts, and they are deliberately written in the style of ancient romance novels. It's true. They're fiction. They're styled as fiction in order to grab your attention. They were literally composed not as history, but as fiction. The fact of the matter is, we don't know how the apostles died. Let's take an example. Let's take, say, the apostle Peter. Clement of Rome, who wrote around the turn of the second century, writes that Peter was killed in Rome on account of jealousy. The jealousy of other members of the community. Not because he was a Christian. The second century apocryphal Acts of Peter said that Peter was convicted on the charge of atheism after having persuaded Agrippa's favorite concubine to practice celibacy. We might just say Agrippa was sort of in a bad mood. But neither of these explanations sound like persecution. As for Peter being crucified upside down, out of humility, the detail of being crucified upside down is in the second century story, but not in the way that we're told in Sunday school. Peter does not say he is unworthy to die like Jesus. He says his death is a symbol of how sin has turned the world upside down. Intriguingly, it is not until 300 years later that the author of one of the 13 other stories about the death of Peter says that Peter asked to be executed upside down out of humility. And this is one of the biting ironies about the history of persecution. We hardly have any early evidence, and the evidence we do have, we're not even reading correctly. When it comes to the descriptions of the other apostles, we encounter the very same problem. None of the apocryphal Acts can be dated any earlier than the second century. They're all written at least a generation after the events they purport to describe. They're filled with stylized and fanciful narratives of talking animals, resurrected smoked fish, and Harry Potter-style battles with magicians. Whoever wrote these stories never so much as met an apostle, much less witnessed their death. The stories about these apostles tell us a lot about how early Christians thought about suffering and death in the second century, but they are not evidence for persecution in the first. The situation is not improved by looking at the Roman evidence. You may have heard this story, for instance. One hot summer night in July of 64 CE, on the eve of the summer games, a fire began in a small shop under the Circus Maximus. The source of the fire is unknown. Perhaps it was just a cooking fire that got out of control and spread. In any case, all of Rome was soon on fire. According to tradition, the people of Rome blamed the Emperor Nero for this great fire. And Nero, in turn, deflected responsibility onto the Christians, who were already much maligned by the people. The Christians were arrested and condemned, and Nero devised terrible tortures for them. They were dressed in the skins of wild animals and then thrown to the beasts to be ripped apart. They were covered in tar and lit on fire to light the night sky. And in this way, the tradition tells us, the persecution of Christians by Roman emperors truly begins. This is the beginning of the age of the martyrs. The interesting thing about this story, as with the story about Peter, is just how late our evidence is. You may have heard, for instance, that Nero fiddled while Rome burned. Yeah. I'm certain he didn't. Not just because fiddles hadn't yet been invented. There is a story about Nero playing the lyre, but that story was written nearly 5 centuries later. The story about Nero burning Christians is earlier, but was still recorded long after the events. It comes from the writings of the Roman historian Tacitus, and it was composed at least 50 years after the fire. And just like the story of Nero playing the fiddle, Tacitus is being anachronistic. In 64 CE, when the great fire took place, followers of Jesus did not yet call themselves Christians. In fact, Jesus' followers do not appear to have started using the name Christian to describe themselves until at the very earliest, the end of the first century. Now, if followers of Jesus weren't even identifying themselves as Christians or seen as a separate group distinct from other Jews, how were they so despised? And how could Nero have singled them out as a group? Well, he couldn't. They didn't exist yet. By the time that our historian Tacitus was writing, Christians had become well known and largely disliked. Tacitus is retrojecting his second century situation back into the first century. Well, why would he do that? What's his motivation? Well, Tacitus famously despises Nero, and he wants to tell a story that illustrates Nero's cruelty. In sum, Tacitus's evidence for growing popular animosity towards Christians in the second century, but once again, he's not telling us anything about their treatment in the first. Our first evidence for Roman emperors interacting with Christians comes in a series of letters between the Roman Emperor Trajan and Pliny, the governor of Bithynia, which is in modern-day Turkey. In them, Pliny writes to Trajan to ask what he should do about these Christians. He says that because of the Christians, the temples are empty and no one is purchasing sacrificial meat. And Pliny had just built this temple. There's a big economic concern here. He says that Christianity is nothing other than a foolish supersitio, a superstition. It's not a religion to him. But that he did discover that Christians are obstinate and stubborn. And he does think that this alone warrants their death. So he decides that if they are persistent, he will execute them. And both he and the Emperor Trajan in his response agree that the Christians who are persistent should be executed, but that the Christians were not to be sought out. Now, the fact that Pliny has to write to Trajan to ask him what to do tells us that there were no measures in place for the treatments of Christians, right? So no governor today would need to write to the Department of Homeland Security to ask, what do we do about an Al-Qaeda operative? He knows already. Pliny would not have had to have written to Trajan if Christians were high on the list of Roman concerns. Moreover, we have to offset the evidence that we get from the Pliny-Trajan correspondence against other stories about Roman governors. One Christian writer tells us of a famous case around 185 CE when a Roman governor in modern-day Turkey, the very same region that Pliny and Trajan are writing about. This Roman governor simply refused to try a group of Christians that wanted to be executed. They came, they banged on his door late at night, they interrupted him, and they asked to die. He told them that if they wanted to die, they had ropes to hang themselves with. And he sent them away. If there had been some kind of lost law that we don't have anymore in which a Roman emperor made Christians illegal, then this governor would not have been able to do this. he would have killed them. There was no legislation in place that required Christians to do anything that might lead them to die until January of 250 CE. Then, the newly acclaimed Roman Emperor Decius issued a decree that everyone in the empire must sacrifice to the genius, which is sort of like the divine personality of the emperor. The decree required that the sacrifice be performed in public in the presence of a Roman magistrate. So a Roman official has to see you do this. And in return, each faithful subject would be provided with a certificate called a labellus, which just means little book, a certificate of proof of participation in this ritual. For most of the common era, scholars and historians assumed that Decius' decree was targeting Christians. They thought this because early Christian historians wrote about the wicked decrees of the Emperor Decius, who had deliberately persecuted the Christians. It was only in the 19th century, when copies of these little books were found, that we started to change our mind. Intriguingly, none of these labellae mention Christians, Christianity, or Jesus. In fact, from the structure of these documents, we can deduce that the decree required that everyone participate in the cult. One of the labellae is signed by a pagan priestess. She's not a Christian. Decius's decree was actually about political loyalty and social uniformity. He was trying to re-energize the imperial cult that already existed. It was a period of crisis, and he thought if he put money into this, that people would then support the empire in a way that they hadn't recently. That Christians experienced the Decian decree as persecution shouldn't surprise us. But that does not mean that Decius himself was intending to persecute the Christians. If we are going to condemn someone for persecution, then surely they have to be aware that they're doing it. What we have here is a short-lived piece of legislation. All of our documentation comes from a single month in 250, 1 month. A short-lived piece of legislation designed to elicit social, political, and religious conformity. That Christians were caught in the crosshairs of this legislation is deeply unfortunate, but it is not evidence of anti-Christian legislation. This is prosecution, not persecution. Only a few years after Decius, the new emperor Valerian took up the case of Christians. He composed some letters about them from the front of the war, where he was in the east, to the Roman Senate. And he demanded that church leaders participate in pagan rituals and the Christians stop meeting in cemeteries at night. He then directed that bishops, priests, and deacons were to be put to death at once, and that Christian senators and high-ranking officials were to lose their status and property. Members of his own household who were found to be Christian were to be packed off to the country where they wouldn't be such a liability. It's interesting, given that the Decian persecution occurred less than a decade earlier, that there are already Christians in high status positions, senators, officials, members of the emperor's own household. In fact, it's surprising that Christians could ever achieve power and status in government if, as tradition has led us to believe, they were being systematically persecuted by that same government. Valerian's letter in the second half of the 3rd century was the first piece of legislation that was specifically directed against Christians. It is important to note that he was concerned only with leaders of the church and high-status Roman citizens. He had little interest in just the rank and file. I'll talk in a minute about why Valerian does this, but what we should note for now is that he has no problem with Christianity in general. He just doesn't want it in his leadership. Up until this point, we've seen Christians caught up in general legislation, the expulsion of Christians from positions of power, and we've seen sets of procedures designed to deal with Christians in the courtrooms. But we have not seen widespread general persecution of the sort described in modern-day sermons. With the Emperor Diocletian, however, we see something very different. His legislation, issued in a series of laws, passed from the February 303 to the spring of 304, inaugurates the first and only period of persecution that fits with our popularly held notions about persecution in the early church. So we're talking about maybe 13 to 18 months. Like earlier legislation, the laws ban Christians from congregating in public, owning property, owning Christian books, holding leadership positions, and that kind of thing. But the fourth and final edict, issued in the spring of 304, was the most severe. It required that everyone, men, women, and children, gather in a public space to offer sacrifice. If they refused, they were to be executed. This period of history, we can all agree, is real persecution. It may not have been as severe as Christian historians have said, and there's a lot of evidence that Christians found ways around these laws, but the legislation is clear. For these 2 years, Christians were, by anyone's estimation, persecuted. The question is, do less than 2 years of persecution under Diocletian add up to nearly 2,000 years of Christian victimhood? Even if the Romans only very rarely persecuted the Christians, we might wonder, why do they have problems with Christians at all? After all, the Romans aren't known for their cruelty when it comes to people of other religions. Quite the opposite. They're known for being comparatively beneficent rulers. So what's the problem with the Christians? Before I turn to the questions of Christians in particular, I want to first look at violence in the ancient world. The bar for capital punishment in the Roman Empire was a little lower than ours. In addition to being executed for murder and treason, you could also be executed for adultery, false witness, causing disruptions at night, or slandering someone in a song. What this means for us, of course, is that the execution of Christians is more exceptional to us as modern readers than it was at the time. This is how you dealt with ancient criminals. They weren't the kind of hippies that would pay to imprison someone at their own expense. Furthermore, Roman society, like most ancient societies, presumed that there was an intimate connection between the gods and the success of the Roman Empire. Politics, religion, and social order were intimately linked with one another. Human flourishing was a delicate affair. There's very little health care. They cannot seek shelter from most of the weather conditions that occurred. So as a means of trying to sustain the social and divine order across the expanse of the Roman Empire, the Romans used the Roman imperial cult. As an institution, it just meant sprinkling some incense in a flame. It was almost like a pledge of allegiance. You went, you said that you were part of the Roman Empire, that you supported it, and then you went home. Christians, however, would not participate in the imperial cult, and in refusing to do so, they were putting the stability of the empire at risk. From an ancient perspective, the presence of a religiously non-compliant group in their midst was a threat to the community. You could anger the gods, and you could bring down the whole empire. Now, to us, it may seem utterly unfair to ask Christians to compromise their religious beliefs like this. But Roman judges weren't entirely sure why Christians wouldn't offer sacrifice. After all, everyone else did. By refusing to participate in the imperial cult, Christians were changing the rules of religious conduct. They were asking for something no one had ever seen before. And to a Roman judge, the protest of ancient Christians that they could not sacrifice made about as much sense as if I would go to my dean and tell him that I couldn't come to work on days when my baseball team plays because those are religious holidays for me. I would probably be fired. He wouldn't say, well, sure, it's a religious thing. Christians threatened to disrupt the Pax Deorum, the peace of the gods, and in doing so, they were inviting destruction on everyone. And for the Romans, Christian non-participation was authentically dangerous. Their stubbornness was not just disrespectful and iconoclastic, it might potentially bring down the empire. And in fact, when we look at the evidence, every point in time when a Roman emperor decided to take action against the Christians was a period in which the Roman Empire was actually under threat politically and militarily. There was a military threat, and the Romans were trying to fend that off. Christians also didn't exactly help themselves out when it came to explaining their positions to Roman judges. To give just one example from my book, because the stories are just so interesting, during his trial, a famous Christian philosopher and teacher named Justin Martyr, guess how he dies, is asked by the Roman judge why he won't display respect and sacrifice to the emperor. Justin says, well, I am being respectful, but I can only be respectful to God. This simply didn't make sense to a Roman judge. Imagine if someone went into a modern courtroom and said that he or she didn't respect the authority of the judge, the law, or the government, only the authority of their God. And so they wouldn't pay taxes or obey the law. They would probably be imprisoned if they had already broken a law, as the Christians had. To the Romans, the things Christians said in courtrooms sounded like sedition. Some Christians talked of their new emperor, Christ, his impending reign, and how they wouldn't recognize Roman authority. Sometimes they would add that they had self-emancipated themselves from slavery or their husbands. Sometimes they would refuse to even give their names. Reading these stories, it's hard to believe that the Christians are actually trying to help themselves out. They were rude, subversive, and disrespectful. And most importantly, they were threatening. It's not difficult to see why the Romans found them utterly incomprehensible. In addition to the fact that they posed a threat to the stability of the Roman Empire and sounded like revolutionaries, Christians suffered from bad publicity. In particular, there were two rumors that circulated about early Christians, which very quickly became accusations. These were that Christians participated in incest, in clandestine sex parties, and that they cannibalized infants. Our sources for these rumors only come from Christians who respond, as you can imagine, with some frustration and anger. Justin Martyr, his version of the rumor describes how after the Eucharist would be celebrated, they would conveniently knock over a lamp, leaving the room in darkness, and participants would be able to drink human blood and have sex with one another without repercussion. I know it sounds like a fire hazard, doesn't it? The 3rd century writer Tertullian repeats the same story, adding more detail about the logistics. The important thing is that before you knock over the lamp, you take note of where your mother and sisters are sat. This is not so you can avoid having sex with them. Quite the reverse. These rumors obviously have no basis in fact. So to give you another variation on cannibalism, apparently catechumens were given infants dusted in flour and told to cut them apart as part of their initiation ritual, they were told that they were cutting bread. It's difficult to imagine anyone could really be duped by this. Most people prefer their bread inanimate and limbless, you know. Whatever the origins of this bad publicity, it was damaging. These are serious crimes. The Romans were happy to kill those who practiced human sacrifice. They thought they were doing a service to society, and they took these crimes very seriously. Taken together, what the lack of evidence for the persecution of Christians means is that we have to reappraise our views of persecution in the early church. The Sunday school narrative of church martyrs, of Christians huddled in catacombs out of fear, is a fairy tale. Even if the actions of the Romans still seem unjust, we have to admit that they had reasons for treating Christians in the way that they did. From an ancient Roman perspective, and from the perspective of most ancient people, the Romans had the moral high ground. They were protecting the empire from the wrath of the gods and its effects. That Christians were executed should not surprise us, given that this is a world in which people pay the ultimate price for seemingly small offenses. It has been said that the history of Christian martyrdom is the history of Christianity itself. Given everything we now know about the overblown nature of the idea that Christians were continually persecuted, we have to wonder, where does this idea come from? The answer, of course, is Christians. We have literally thousands of stories of Christian martyrs being brutally tortured and killed, but the overwhelming majority of these stories were written long after the events that they purport to describe. Innumerable stories about martyrs were fabricated in order to support local churches and attract wealthy pilgrims to particular towns. The practice of collecting and displaying holy relics exploded in the 5th century, and everyone wanted a piece of the action. Even the earliest stories have been edited and reworked. Authors of these accounts borrowed from ancient mythology and changed the details of the events to make the Romans more venomous. We need not accuse the prescribes who created these accounts of malicious deception, because this kind of practice was very common in the ancient world. But we cannot conclude that they're giving us the historical facts. Even if Christians choose to venerate martyrs, they should not leap to the conclusion that ancient Christians as a collective whole were constantly persecuted. We simply lack the necessary evidence to support such a claim. Faith in martyrs is one thing. Historical claims about persecution are another. Claims about violent persecution may not be historically accurate, but in the hands of ancient church writers, they did valuable work shoring up the authority of the church. Church historians, never mentioned in the Sunday school stories, used martyrs to combat heresy and establish the succession of bishops. To give a brief example, one church historian, when he wanted to demonstrate the errors of a particular heresy, would tell stories in which a martyr had denounced the schismatic group's leader. Later generations of medieval copyists did exactly the same, inserting doctrinal formula into the mouths of expiring martyrs. Early church historians have begun a long-lived tradition of equating dissent and disagreement with persecution. They have argued that the church is fundamentally under attack, and that just as Roman officials attacked her in the past, now heretics attack her in the present. The essential idea here is polarization. It's us against them, good against evil. Once Constantine allowed Christianity to become the state religion, Christians went on the offensive. They destroyed pagan shrines in the hope of becoming martyrs. It's not that the experience of authentic persecution made Christians generous and forgiving. quite the reverse. It enabled them to attack others, and they just heaped violence on top of violence, using persecution language as their justification. This idea of constant attack and Christian victimhood is grounded in the myths of the early church, but it endures to this day. It's evident in the rhetoric of modern American media pundits, political and religious leaders, who proclaim that there's a war on Christianity in modern America. The problem with identifying oneself and one's group as a persecuted minority is that it necessarily identifies others as persecutors. This makes conversation, much less collaboration, impossible. Moreover, it overshadows actual persecution. It is certainly the case that Christians and members of other religious groups are persecuted in other parts of the world. They do face violence and oppression, but it is rarely those voices or calls to action that actually reach our ears. If we use the term persecution in a broad way to describe disagreements about lawmaking, then we will quickly run out of language. We will have taken all the words. If we do not keep persecution language for situations of actual persecution, then we risk making unspeakable violence actually indescribable. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Moss, for that great talk. And it's time for questions and answers. And I'd like to remind our online and radio audiences that they are listening to Professor Candida Moss, the author of The Myth of Persecution, speaking at the Commonwealth Club in California. First question.
When I first encountered this and had suspicions of it, I focused on the really unbelievable story of Saint Perpetua, who takes the nursing infant from her breast and pushes away her aged father, who says he will perish without her company, and welcomes and encourages a young man, just a kid, who's also a captive, to go joyously to the horrible death of being eaten by beasts in the arena. I mean, it's simply absurd.
Well, I write about this story and others in my book, and I think that you're right. And some of those absurdities are things such as she's supposed to be an upper-class Roman aristocrat. Upper-class women did not breastfeed their own infants, so it doesn't make sense. Her father's beaten in the courtroom. Upper-class men were not publicly beaten by Roman judges. It just didn't happen. And where is her husband if she's so well married? Her child legally belongs to her husband, and yet he's nowhere in the account. I think you're right. There are elements of that story that mean that even as this is a diary, our first piece of Christian woman's literature, that yes, we absolutely have to treat that with some suspicion, if not a lot of suspicion.
During the Roman Empire, they had great wars with the Persians. Mm-hmm. And the Persians were Zoroastrian. Mm-hmm. So is there any historical evidence of Zoroastrians existing in the Roman society, and how were they treated?
The Romans were very suspicious of anything that came from the East. So from the beginning of the 3rd century, they were outlawing magical practices that they associated with the Persians. Diocletian, who passes the legislation against Christians that people hear about all the time. No one ever hears about the legislation against the Manichaeans and against the Zoroastrians. So he outlawed Manichaeism because he thought it came from Persia and it was a foreign religion infecting the beautiful Roman Empire. And so, yes, there is evidence out there, and it's very much overshadowed by this history of Christian persecution. This is precisely what Christian persecution language does. It makes every instance of violence that involves Christians only about Christians. And there are often other groups that are also being targeted.
Yeah, I've tried to study some of that myself over the same period, although since you're the scholar in it, it's great to be here. I wanted to ask you, it was about, you know, the period between Diocletian mm-hmm. and when Constantine mm-hmm. declared himself a Christian, and that was going to be the official religion of the empire. There was a period in there, mm-hmm. and what sort of happened in there, and also what percentage of the empire were actually Christians at the time of that declaration by Constantine?
Right. These are really interesting questions. So what happens after Diocletian? So Diocletian actually was part of a tetrarchy, a rule of four. There are three other empires, emperors, and they divided up the empire. The Diocletian persecution only was really severe in the area ruled by Diocletian and his co-emperor in the east. Once Diocletian steps down, his co-emperor may have continued the persecution, particularly from 306 to 311. In other parts of the empire, it seems that there may have been no persecution at all. At all. It may just, none of the legislation was implemented in, say, barbarian Britain, you know? They have bigger fish to fry. Now, our sources are complicated here, but it does seem like, in terms of how many Christians there are, we have no idea. What we do know, recent archaeological excavation has shown that Christians, only about 5% of them went to church. Only about 5% of them could fit in churches. For all you hear about declining church attendance, it was never that great. What does this mean? Well, how are they going to get found out? So we don't really know, but it does mean there are all of these situations in which Christians could avoid detection. So you could give power attorney to your pagan brother-in-law, and suddenly you're right around Diocletian's first edict. So our evidence is complicated.
Could you speak to how the Romans treated the Jews with respect to their religious beliefs? For example, did Jews sacrifice mm-hmm. to the genius of the emperor?
Yeah, this is really interesting. Our Jewish sources tell us that they had special exemption. And this is what I learned when I was in graduate school, that, you know, the poor Christians, because they thought that they, like the Jews, got a special dispensation. Recent archaeological excavations in ancient Palestine have demonstrated that the imperial cult was alive and well there, which means that the Jews were participating. Did they negotiate a special rule? Sure, they did. But they also were much less threatening. They're this old religion that is not recruiting. You know, they're not really recruiting converts. Christianity isn't explaining itself even in terms of we're just like the Jews. Moreover, when Pliny says they're a superstitio is like, it's described as mania. It's sort of like being insane, except it's catching. So you can contaminate people with your Christianity, and now they're not going to participate. So you can see how the Romans see them sort of completely differently. Our evidence for the Roman treatment of Jews is sort of mixed. We have some evidence that they made great accommodations for the Jews, and we have some evidence that when they got tired of that, they acted swiftly, decisively, and quite brutally. But most people would have said, they're the ruling power. This is the reality. You know, the empire decides what gets done.
I found your talk very, very interesting, and I was quite fascinated, and I heard you on the radio yesterday. And my first thought was, how has your research been received by the University of Notre Dame, as you are a professor there, and are they encouraging you to proceed in finding this information that is truth-seeking?
This is on the radio. You know, the administration of the University of Notre Dame has been very supportive of my academic freedom. I got a very nice note from our provost saying that I should, you know, go where the facts take me. I'm respecting my academic freedom. Are there people at Notre Dame that are unhappy that I decided that this was what I was going to do with my time? I'm sure there are. I don't know if I would have written this book as a graduate student or if I didn't have tenure.
Now that you've exposed Christianity, do you intend to expose other world religions like Islam?
I would have to go and get a lot of training to do that. You know, I'm a specialist in Christianity. I think one of the reasons I chose to write this book is that I teach at a Catholic school. I'm Roman Catholic myself. And this is a myth that's so integral to Roman Catholic identity. I thought that it gave me a certain kind of authority to say, as a Catholic, we need to get our facts straight. We cannot use misconceptions about the past to talk about the present. And so that was one of the reasons I did it. So I don't feel like I have a lot of bona fides when it comes to talking about Islam, but I will get back to you.
I'd like to ask a question about the evolution of the attitude toward martyrdom in general. Mm-hmm. My wife and I, in wandering through European museums, have noted after some time that you can practically date a portrait of the death of Saint Sebastian by counting the arrows. The earlier the portrait, the more arrows there are. Mm-hmm. And if you look, say, at a 10th century picture, it's like a pincushion. Mm-hmm. If you go to, say, a late Renaissance one, there's just one or two arrows. Mm-hmm. Could you comment on the implications of that?
Yeah, there was a sudden crescendo with the explosion of martyrdom writing. People started developing worse and worse tortures and modes of death in order to outdo each other. It's a lot like horror movies now. You know, they're getting increasingly more gruesome. And then they reach a critical mass and people want to go to some sort of suspense-filled genre instead. We don't need to see the violence. And so there was a definite interest in torture. Some scholars have written about the kind of voyeuristic quality that both the artwork and the stories have from sort of the 6th through 12th centuries. And I think by the time you get to the Renaissance, I'm no art historian, what you're seeing is two arrows is really enough to kill him. You know, we don't need to overdo it. It gets a little bit crass, you know.
What do you feel was the church's benefit to perpetrating the myth of persecution?
I don't think at any point in time, you know, sort of church leaders sat around a round table in a darkened room, you know, conspiring. It was certainly something that happened organically. And I think that in the past, as today, when people talked about persecution, they sincerely meant it. They thought they were under attack from heretics. They thought when they were powerful and the Ottoman Empire was on the rise, they did think that they were banging on the door of St. Peter's, even though they were thousands of miles away. That, of course, doesn't make those actions right. I think with generally, a lot of it's about economics. So, you know, literally come to our town, see our martyr, buy our stuff, spend money here. There's a lot of competition between different shrines because they did bring the wealthy to those towns. And I think at the same time, it's hard to persuade someone to change their opinion. It is. And you know, a great story about your religious hero telling you what to believe is worth 1,000 logical arguments about why that's correct. And so what they're doing is they're harnessing the power of narrative and the charisma of these figures in order to tell people, this is what you should believe. This is what it means to be a Christian.
Maybe you could add a little bit about the pilgrimage culture of that time, because you were talking about the money coming to the villages, but there were famous pilgrimage sites throughout Europe with Canterbury Tales and stuff.
Right. Yeah, there are these famous pilgrimage sites. And what's interesting is, so people would want to go see where Stephen died, the first martyr. So there was another shrine nearby, the Shrine of Thecla, and they describe her as the first female martyr. So while you're on your way, don't you want to stop off and see the first female martyr too? And, you know, this was really the only people who can make these kinds of pilgrimages are very wealthy. And travel is very slow. They're going to spend a while there. They're going to bring a lot of money. And you could charge people to eat fruit that had grown on trees, that grew in the earth, that was nearby a river that ran through the shrine of a saint. You know, it's like buying T-shirts at Disneyland.
Sort of as a follow-up question to this woman's, I'm wondering how you would describe the development of Christianity since and into this modern day, and particularly in the United States. I'm thinking in terms of fundamentalist Christianity and all the different ways it's kind of fragmented itself.
Wow. As an English Catholic, I have to profess a lot of ignorance about the history of American Christianity and perhaps America in general. I would say that when people have talked about this, the Catholic Church says there's this one true church, and along the way, all of these other denominations split off. You know, they're schismatics. The Orthodox Church says there was this one true church, and along the way, all these other schismatic groups broke off. What I've seen in sort of forms of Protestantism is this return. You know, the narrative is more, there was a one true church, it got perverted, it went astray, and what we need to do is reclaim, you know, what Jesus was like, how the apostles were. I think that in any situation where you have human beings who can potentially disagree with one another, you're going to see schism and division. I think that in Protestant denominations where you see so much of that, I think that's more honesty. So in the past, Catholics have just said, well, leave, go join a Protestant denomination. You know, so there's a different way of dealing with that kind of dissent in the church that allows them to maintain, allows us to maintain this sort of rhetoric of unity against any kind of evidence to the contrary. The way we tell it was the first group breaks off and then they all schism from each other. But we were always unified. So it's a question. I think there's a lot of rhetoric of self-presentation. Yeah, there's, you know, recent scholarship into the Great Library of Alexandria has shown that it wasn't that great. It had no more than 1,000 volumes, which is a lot, right? That's a lot of books. But it's not the library we were told it was. I was just at UC Berkeley today, and the Roman historians there were telling me they thought it never existed. That said, did the Christians destroy a lot of pagan artifacts, including literature? Yes, they did. And they thought they were protecting Christianity when they did it.
Mm-hmm. Came out and tells the story of how at the monasteries they'd actually preserved some of these, mm-hmm. not knowing what was in them. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's a lot of evidence that Christian scribes were not as savvy as we might have thought. Yeah, there were a lot of pagan martyrs killed by the Christians. And in fact, there's one amazing bishop who was just disliked in Alexandria during sort of roughly that time period. So Hypatia, yes, you may have seen the movie with Rachel Weisz. She was killed by the Christians. There was this one Christian bishop who was lynched by a Christian mob. They all kicked him, they tied him to a camel, they took the camel outside of the city, and then they set it on fire. I know what you're thinking. What did that camel do to deserve it? And he's not revered as a martyr because church historians have said, well, he was a heretic. So anyone, according to Christian tradition, from then until very recently, anyone who is not a Christian, so they're a pagan, or not an Orthodox Christian, so they're a heretic, they're not a martyr. That's the way the argument goes. Right. Well, you know, you can look back and say they're Orthodox. Yeah, Gibbon and I do disagree. I don't think there was a Decian persecution. I think the editing was much more pronounced than he did, and I don't think there was malicious lying the way Gibbon did. Gibbon never managed to penetrate popular consciousness. For some reason, we keep saying this. I get a lot of mail from people who haven't read the book, you know, because this is a cherished idea. I did get one letter, though, that was very pleased about. I got two emails from this person. The first email said, "How dare you? You're persecuting the church." And then he followed it up with, "Oh, I actually started reading your book. And I've only read the introduction, but I think, you know, maybe I've been wrong and maybe I could learn something." So if everyone did that, I think it would be great.
Do you think there's any connection between the victimhood attitude inside the church and their victimization of other groups over time? It goes together with the disagreements, but...
Yeah, I think there is. This is a polarizing worldview. It necessitates response. I talk about it more in the book, but yes, I do.
Sure. Then you should read it in the book. Thank you very much, Professor Moss. It was a great talk. And there will be books available out in the lobby, I think outside the Blue Room, and Professor Moss is available to sign them if you'd like. And so ends another event at the Commonwealth Club in its 111th year of enlightened discussion. Thank you very much for coming.